Hi, I'm Chad Hughes, and you're listening to Elevated Access, the Inside Story. This episode, I met with Chris Lupuschuk, an access professional with a wide range of experience across North America and Europe. Chris takes us on an adventure to Serbia, selling everything and moving his family across the globe to pursue an opportunity with a mining project near Bor, Serbia. He breaks down how he developed a project team of local resources, how he outwit corruption, and how practices used in Canada became a huge success factor in Serbia. Chris shares how he paved the way for trust and rapport within the project area. He describes the stakeholder dynamics unique to Serbia, the rugged terrain, and just how difficult agricultural conditions are there. He shares some sound advice that you won't want to miss. Let's tune in to the conversation with Chris. Chris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me today.
So when you and I talked about you coming on the podcast, we very quickly concluded that it would be very interesting for our listeners to hear about your time in Serbia. I'm excited to talk with you today about that. Why don't we start with a quick overview just of your background leading up to your departure to Serbia?
Sure. Yeah. I started working in land acquisition back in 2005 while I was attending Olds College and taking a land acquisition management program there. After a few years of working with a couple brokers on some big projects, I ended up going in-house with a large pipeline company. I worked with them for almost a decade and moved to various different cities across the country. And in late 2016, I got a call from a previous manager who I was working for at that pipeline company, and who had in the years prior had moved to a mining company. And he called and said, "Hey, I have this opportunity in Serbia. We're building a copper and gold mine in eastern Serbia, and we need to buy a lot of land to set up this infrastructure. And I think you'd be a good fit. You should throw your name in the hat." And so we threw our name in the hat and eventually landed a position to go work internationally in Serbia.
What was it like when you were asked to put your name in the hat? Were you fishing or were you actually thinking, man, this would be really cool. I want to do this.
Well, at first I thought it was complete madness. The last time I'd really heard about Serbia in the news was during some of the wars back in the early 90s and early 2000s. And frankly, just because it hadn't been on my radar in so long, it just seemed like it was probably a pretty dangerous place, you know, not really looking into it. But after a few heart-to-heart conversations with my previous manager and with my wife and doing some online sleuthing and Google, we rode around in the Google car a lot in various different communities in throughout Serbia and the Balkans to get kind of a feel for what things were like. And we soon realized that the country actually had, it wasn't the same as it was 20 years ago and 30 years ago during the wars. It was a place that was thriving and it was moving towards ascension in the EU. And it seemed like a really neat opportunity for an adventure for me and my family.
So when you were offered the role, what stood out to you at that time as like, what was really behind that decision? Was it the adventure, the experience? What really prompted you to say, okay, I'm going to do it?
Well, for us, it really had to do with the adventure. When we actually looked on a map and saw where Serbia was, you know, it's only a few hours drive to Budapest or to Romania or to, you know, Prague is driving distance. You could head to, you know, Bratislava or all of these various places. It's really centrally located. And we thought, you know, if we go there with our kids, we could have quite the adventure and you know, work and live and see the culture of Europe. Another big selling point for us was that our kids were going to be going to a private school. And we thought that would be a pretty nice platform for them in early in their schooling to help them succeed later on in life. So that those were some big drivers for us.
How old were your kids at the time?
So our youngest would have been about 6 and our oldest would have been about 10.
What an adventure. Tell us what that was like, moving your family across the pond to a new country. What was that like?
We were really nervous, but I guess I was going to be the proverbial bird into the mine and going and checking it out first before anyone else. And so I'd given my notice at my previous company in, I think it was near the middle of February, early to mid-February of 2017. And my first day was going to be on March 1st of 2017. I got on a plane about the 26th of February, I believe. And I headed out first for the first few months while the rest of my family stayed behind to get our things in order. We actually severed our ties with Canada. We sold our house, we sold our vehicles, we sold all of our belongings. We packed, I believe it was 13 suitcases on our final trip, and we made the move. But for me, going out there the first time, I was really nervous. I was put up in a hotel in a really nice part of town. So I arrived there. I didn't know anybody. The first night was really tough to really get your bearings because the time change was so drastic. It was, I think, a 6 hour or 7 hour difference at that time, and from where I was. And I just remember like the jet lag was really hard that first time because I just wasn't used to a trip like that. You know, after getting my bearings the first day, I went for a walk downtown and I saw a lot of the remnants of the wars, and there were some buildings that had still stood, but you could see the red carpet dangling from the former, I believe it was like their head armed forces office downtown Belgrade. And you could see the reminders on the billboards and that were painted on the walls that, you know, those were left in place as a reminder of, you know, what war can do out there. So it was pretty nerve-wracking the first little while. Some of my colleagues, new colleagues that I'd met in the first 24 to 48 hours. They sort of showed me around the capital. And then my first day was on March 1st. And I started the first few days from my office in Belgrade and just kind of got set up with our IT stuff. And then I think it was a weekend. It was my birthday, actually. It was my birthday on early March. Some of my colleagues who used to work for a really popular soccer team in Belgrade decided to take us out for a match. And I'd never been to a soccer match. I don't really know much about soccer. And I'll tell you, Chad, that was an experience. There was a fire burning at somewhere in the stadium the entire match. There were smoke bombs being thrown. There were security forces all of the way around the pitch. And there were times you couldn't even see the opposing team's goaltender just because there was so much smoke on the field. And the game went on and the chants proceeded. And I'm not even sure who won the game, but it really gave me a flavor for, you know, this is, it's a little different here. I shared a lot of my experiences on Facebook at that time. And obviously when my wife saw photos and videos like that, she became a little bit concerned, but I did a lot of FaceTiming with her and the family, like from the different streets. And within a few days, I'll tell you, you could tell it was one of the safest places I'd ever been. And so that, you know, once those first preliminary jitters were gone and got to tour around a little bit, we knew it was the right decision.
How many days were you there before you had your first day on the job?
Yeah, I was only there for 2 or 3 days by the time I actually had my first official day. Getting set up in the capital you know, that was a little bit of a taste of what Serbia was, but that wasn't going to be where I would be spending the majority of my time. My team and the project were actually located about a 3-hour drive east of Belgrade in a small old mining district called Bor. And it's near the, it's a pretty close drive to the Romanian and Bulgarian borders in just off the Danube in eastern Serbia.
So a little mining town?
Yeah, I it's been a while since I was there, but I think the population of the city was 30,000. And then there were some, there were some villages around. Mining in that area, some of our studies that we were doing in the area, we found examples of mining from back in like the Roman periods. So mining had been there for a long time. And officially, I think it was 1903 when the first copper mine was built in that area. And it was still running to that day. At the time, it was actually a state-owned mine.
So tell us about the project and the need. You mentioned a prior colleague reached out to you and needed help with access, and off you went. So what was the project? What did they need it for?
So when I originally started the project, we were going through some studies to determine if it was going to be a copper and gold project or just a copper project. And shortly after I arrived, it was determined that feasibility of extracting gold wasn't going to necessarily be in our best interest just due to the market and due to the, I think there was an issue with arsenic and processing. And so there were some environmental restrictions that made it not viable at the time. So it proceeded as a copper mine. I guess some of the background was there was a large copper find in the years preceding my arrival, and it had been studied through a series of drilling programs and determined to be one of the highest concentration copper ore bodies that was undeveloped in the world. In order to extract it, there was going to be a number of facilities required, you know, to actually pull the ore out of the ore body, process the ore, and then store all of the tailings that would come along with it. And so when I arrived, there was a need for property, but it was unknown as to what that property would be. So it was piecemealed out to me at first. I think we had it in zones or something. It was like, okay, well, zone one, that's going to be our main focus because that's where we're going to be installing some decline shafts. And that's some of our first works. And then the second zone was going to, you know, have a processing facility. And there were a number of different zones, and things were fairly out of sequence, I guess. It was sort of all over the place when I arrived there. And you could see pretty quickly that land acquisition for a private project like that had likely never happened before, and in fact it actually hadn't. This project at the time represented the largest greenfield investment in Serbia in the history of the country. So it was a really important project. There was a lot of land that was going to be needed to be purchased, and even a few people needed to be, and their families needed to be resettled.
How many acres, or do they maybe don't talk in terms of acres there. Maybe it's hectares, but our listeners will probably be familiar with acres. How large of a area are we talking here?
The footprint changed a lot, but by the time the dust settled on everything, it was about 1,000 hectares or 3,000 acres approximately. And if my memory serves me well, I think we had between 12 and 1,300 parcels within that footprint. 450 to 500 property owners to deal with.
So what, tell us, like, what was the reception like? And you started reaching out to these people that owned this property. How did it go?
Well, the initial touch points actually started before my arrival. There was a small team had been assembled of local nationals. Again, land acquisition for private industry for something of this magnitude just didn't exist before. There was a bit of a slow rollout that had happened over the course of a couple years where a few parcels were acquired. There was a general sort of system established as to how much we would pay for things, but it wasn't really set in stone. It wasn't consistent. It needed essentially to get structured from the ground up. And when I first arrived, there was quite a bit of resistance from the locals, you know, bringing in a foreigner to tell someone how to do their job on land that's, you know, it's not my land. And once I one of the first things I did with the staff that I was inheriting and a few other folks that we weren't sure if they would be under my umbrella or not, I did a quick survey just to see, you know, who are you? You know, what's your name? How long have you been with the company? What's your role? What do you do? What do you think you should be doing? Just general questions like that to just kind of give them an opportunity to inform me of who they were. And then I set up individual meetings with each person to talk to them about that and explain sort of how North American land acquisition strategies work and some of the basics, you know, the fundamentals of what we do. One of the big things that we were really going to try and sell people on was consistent dealings and making sure that we get a message across that, you know, if you're not going to be treated special, if you dig your heels in the ground, we're actually going to be more than fair and we're going to be consistent across the board. You know, these are really small communities we were working in. And so when I explained to the staff that, you know, this information, as people start signing up with us and working with us, and we keep these consistent dealings together, they'll soon realize that we mean it. You know, it took a little while I'd say a couple weeks to sort of get buy-in from the staff, but, and not just local staff, but even the superiors at that time, some of the people I was working with in that area hadn't been on a project where it moved from that exploration phase into the actual development and readying for construction. So formulating sort of the sales pitch to explain, you know, your goal is here and we are here. And this is, you know, here's how I feel would be best for us to get from A to B. And so I built a structure of sort of fundamental processes that I thought we were going to need. We were going to need an administration group. We were going to need an acquisition, like a field group. We were also going to need a GIS group and a state land acquisition group, because it was very different to acquire state lands in that country. The Serbian government had recently updated the Mining Act in the country. Working through the amendments that now existed and making sure that our processes aligned with those amendments and were in line with not only Serbian laws and regulations, but also international standards was part of the initial stages of getting ready to roll out this acquisition program. And once I had buy-in at the upper echelons of the company and in the staff, and they realized that this actually might work, we started building our team.
How big did the team get from when you arrived to, you know, mid project point?
We started with three, and when I left, by the end of the project at our max, we were at 19 staff.
Mm-hmm. I got the sense that you had to, you know, when you described all the needs that you identified, that you'd have to staff up quite a bit. I'm curious to know how your experience in Canada helped you identify what those needs were. Was it a combination of your experience in Canada, or was it the result of a certain role you were in Canada prior to going over there?
Well, I would say it was a combination of various things. Early in my career, you know, a lot of companies were, you know, trying to stick to consistent dealings, and everyone had sort of their own methodologies of how compensation would be paid, and certain areas would get X and certain areas would get Y. And I later moved from clustered projects that were more, I guess, oil and gas drilling programs to linear pipeline projects. And marrying the experience from both of those lines of work really prepared me for this specific project. It wasn't only, you know, sporadic, just sort of little islands of impact. It was a giant impact, and was going to impact a lot of people in a pretty big circumference. So we had to look at, you know, a lot of the learnings that we found that I'd taken in Canada, like, you know, what happens to the people on the other side of the fence? I'll call it a fence, but essentially the other side of the line of where we're acquiring property. You know, if we're paying X times whatever as a, you know, a signing consideration and potentially elevating property values, what about the poor farmers on the other side of the fence that their tax values were suddenly, you know, potentially going to go up? And because we saw that in Canada, where, you know, if we weren't careful with the way that we justified the rates we were paying on various projects, we could farther impact, you know, other people in the area. And so we, you know, going and working with the Serbian municipal government tax authorities to explain that, you know, us buying a property and structuring payment, we're purposely structuring it where there's a market value and then there's other values assigned to that, because the market value can't change. If we change the market value, we're going to harm, you know, others in this area. And so that was, you know, a good example, I think, of one of the things that we brought there, and it had never even been contemplated before. And, you know, it was almost like some people in the government were thinking, ooh, this is going to be great because now our tax base is going to go up. But realistically, you know, a lot of people in this area, there were some poor farmers that would be impacted that could never afford these increases in taxes. So we had to be very careful and considerate of everybody, not just the people who are going to have their property purchased.
Very proactive of you to approach it that way. And, you know, the sticking with the, you know, using a similar pattern for dealing with people in the same area, that sure resonates, because that's definitely something that, you know, we were taught right out of college that it's a no-no to go and do one deal on this side of the road and another on this side of the road, or at least it was discouraged. So leading, like, I want to come back to that, the team that was in place, how were they contemplating acquiring all this property when it came to the deal structure and these precedents or patterns of dealings? How were they planning to do it?
The plan was, one by one, as farmers or as property owners come and visit us and express their interest in selling to us, we will buy. And nobody was coming. There were just a few people that had actually gone and done that. And so, you know, structuring a team that was going to actively be out building, you know, I'll call them line lists, because I think our listeners will likely be able to understand what that is. You know, building those databases of people, setting up a comprehensive GIS program to be able to track, you know, what phase of the interactions are we with, or are we in with every single parcel of property, and be able to visualize that and be able to target specific areas. A big challenge that we saw out there actually was a result of some corruption that was going on with the government a few years before I had arrived. Now, this was a private project, but a few years before I got there, the government was planning to expand a mine that they owned in an area just a little bit to the north of where we were going to be. And what they were doing was identifying the areas that they were going to be buying behind closed doors. getting their friends and other government officials to go and buy these properties from these owners at pennies on the dollar, and then flipping that property back to the government agents or land people who would come and see them and pay, you know, 10 or whatever times a premium on all of these properties. So this story was, you know, everybody knew about it. And so everyone thought, well, you know, they're just going to, if we sell it now, they're just going to pay more. And so you had to kind of make a balance as to what is an attractive offer? What is a fair offer? And how do we, you know, how do we avoid speculators? They were going to be a big problem. And so we started looking for trends on and getting reports from the land titles offices to what properties were transferring hands every single month. And so we started seeing that there were names popping up in the districts and areas that we were planning on purchasing land from that were doing the same thing. These were people that knew about that government program that were trying to take advantage of us and figure out a way that they could, you know, essentially rip off people. And so there were likely moles within the company who were coming in and looking at maps or, you know, attending meetings. And we have no idea who these people would be, because they could have been anyone. They could have been the cleaner for that matter. And so there were properties that were getting bought, again, like what I would call pennies on the dollar. And then we would approach with our comprehensive plan of compensation. And then they would capitalize on, you know, on these vulnerable people. We incorporated a lot of different techniques to deal with them. One of the things that they were able to, that Serbia has in place for agricultural land is, if you are an agricultural owner and you decide to sell agricultural land and you come to a deal with someone, the owner with the longest agricultural border with your piece of property has a right of first refusal automatically. And so some of these speculators were even trying to build their own little empires around our properties. So what we would do is find out where they were, pinpoint them, and then build a donut of properties around them so that we could give ourselves the right of first refusal, and then buy those properties surrounding their properties to isolate them.
Oh, wow.
Crazy, crazy stuff. There was a, this is a funny one. There was I called it zone critical. There was a critical zone that was identified by our engineers. Again, this is a bit of a story that had to get acquired. And I picked this critical zone because I knew that there were a few land speculators in that area. And we drew it on a map and we just left it in our office. And in the weeks following, and I even sent people to go and like evaluate some properties in zone critical. Zone critical actually never existed. Zone critical was set up as a decoy so we could focus on the areas that we really needed to acquire while the land speculators went and spent all their money in zone critical. And it worked like a charm. You could just see we used red on our mapping to show like, you know, the colors of what we would, what we thought were speculators in the area. And zone critical just like turned into like a big red balloon within just a few weeks. Yeah. and yeah, you know, they're our neighbors now. But
that's crazy. So there definitely was someone or people inside the organization somewhere that we're leaking that information. That's clever. Yeah,
absolutely. And so we did little things in our office. Like I had a really good relationship with our GIS lead. We had a neat setup in our land office where we had like a bullpen and then a perimeter of desks and then a bullpen in the middle. It just made for really good team communication. You know, when the field guys would come in, we would take 15 minutes and we would all talk to them, the administrators, the GIS people, everyone, because it would really help us stay on top of where we were and keep us in line with our goals. But I turned our GIS person's desk around. And so he was one of just two people in the company that actually knew what maps we were really going after. And it was really the only way for us to keep this information confidential in light of these speculators.
So what do you think, like, some of the other challenges were with the project from an access perspective?
Well,
what else stands out?
I would say impacts. You know, we did have to resettle around 20 families that were impacted by this program. And, you know, our presence as a foreign entity was new. And a lot of people, you know, had maybe more nationalistic ideals when it came to mineral rights, and working with them and letting them see that the people that were going to benefit from this project were the locals. Like, my staff, out of the 19 people I hired, two of them were from Belgrade. One was from a village from about an hour away, and the rest were locals. And so by having that local presence in the field and people seeing, you know, their sons and daughters and uncles and aunts, and, you know, the workforce was massive, and they, you know, the area had been depressed economically for so long that this was going to reinvigorate things. And once, you know, the word of mouth of how well people were treated, the safety culture we had, the pay was top notch, the consistent dealings we were having with everybody, that message just really resonated through the community. And I think we, you know, over the course of only a few months, we had a lot of support behind us.
What was it like pulling the title or the land ownership? I know it's different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. We're very spoiled in Canada for the most part with how we do it. How onerous of a task was that?
Well, that was a beast for sure, for us to tackle. So when a country goes through the number of wars and even different governments that it had been in the last 100 years, things can get pretty messy. So Serbia was, as you likely know, it was formerly part of Yugoslavia, which was a communist nation. And under a communist collective, land isn't really owned by the individual. It's owned by the people. There had been a big movement from the time of the collapse of Yugoslavia where, you know, making sure that people who owned land prior to Yugoslavia and their relatives were now becoming property owners. There were some gaps in the cadastro system there. And so we would work with the local cities, and essentially every single parcel that we identified, we would have to do a due diligence exercise to go through the ownership as far back as it went. It was usually, you know, like 100 years. And there was also an occupation by the Austro-Hungarian Empire just prior to World War I. And then the Nazis also took over that area prior to or during World War II. And when those occupations happened, different cadastral systems were actually introduced that had more of a similar feel to what we would see out west, as far as, like, you know, parcel data and numbering and a system to organize that. And a lot of those ended up being learnings, I guess you could say, and those systems sort of lived through the Yugoslavian times and eventually made way for a cadastral system. Now, in 2017 or 2018, the state was going through an exercise where they were starting to digitize all of the properties within Serbia. And so they were at a point where all of the different municipalities were working with the folks in Belgrade to digitize the system. But things weren't orchestrated very well at that time. Like, systems were, they just weren't ready for integration of everything. So we did, it was a lot of physical legwork. A lot of times when we'd run into a title that had like a conflict or something on it, we would physically have to go to the cadastral office and work with the people in the office and sit and have a coffee with them and hope that they would invite us into the archives where we could go and look. Otherwise it would just be a request that would sit on their pile of requests that was like a foot deep, and the turnaround wasn't very quick sometimes. So it was really challenging. That's probably the best way to explain that.
Yeah. So of the, I think you mentioned, what was it, 450 different parcel owners? Yep. How many of those people did you have to relocate?
There were around 20 families that were relocated in total. So what we did with each family is they were some of the first people that we approached, because it was, you know, we wanted to make sure there was a long runway to work with them. And every single family that we worked with either already had a home in one of the villages or in the city, and were likely getting their livelihood from jobs that they had there, or were really eager to move into the city so that they could go and take advantage of a better economic situation there. So we would work with local realtors, find houses that would meet their needs, help facilitate the purchase of these homes, and any residual money that was left over from the purchase of the land would go back to the property owner and help them with resettlement. We would check in with them. Well, they had a 24-hour line to call us if they ever needed any help with anything, and we would check on with them usually monthly to make sure that there were that everything was okay. And after around 6 months to a year, once they got tired of hearing from us and their lives were, you know, all of them I would say were going in a better direction, they were done with us and they were actually really happy to work with us.
And of those people, like did many of those families were many of those families relocated to other farms, or was it these were residential properties and they went on to do something?
None of
else.
Them went on to other farms. The option was there if they wanted it, but none of them went into other farms. In the little villages out there, Chad, like you can have a couple cows and a couple sheep and a couple pigs in your yard. Like that's normal in the villages, not necessarily in the city. Mm-hmm. So some of them who had that set up, what were say, a 5 mile walk from the nearest village, could now set that up in the village and be a 5 minute walk away from the store in town and from the posta to get their mail. And everyone had a specific situation, but luckily for us, everybody seemed very satisfied with the outcome.
Try not to digress here, but I'm curious about, like, I've got this picture in my mind of what it's like there. So I'm curious to know what topographically, what's the topography like, and describe that, and these farms or these properties, were a lot of them smaller like that? Like, did they have big machinery that they worked the fields with? I've got a vision in my mind, but like, frame that up for us. What is it really like?
Well, Chad, you and I both come from agricultural backgrounds, and neither one of us would find this area suitable for agricultural operations. Poor soil conditions. Yeah, there was a lot of poor soil conditions. This was like a lot of undulating terrain, scrub brush in a lot of different areas, and the parcelization, there was really no rhyme or reason as to how parcels were divvied out. You know, if you look in Eastern Canada, you notice long, skinny parcels, which one piece of them touches a river. Not the case in Eastern Serbia. It's like take a box of puzzle pieces and just drop them onto a table and just sort of like flatten them out. That's your parcels. The parcel sizes were so erratic that there was one parcel that we acquired that had been severed off by a state highway that had been built. I'll give you the measurements of this parcel. 3 meters by 3 meters by 3 meters. It was a triangle. And that was a parcel. So
what?
Yeah, you can't You can't do anything with that. Look, there were a few folks that actually had viable agricultural operations, mainly to do with some haying. There were some bee farmers out there that had some really good honey operations. You know, it was working with them to help them find new locations for, you know, the right vegetation for their bee colonies in close proximity to their farms. You know, that made us have to look outside of our circle of what we were trying to acquire. And in many cases, we would actually go and buy properties in proximity to the area so that we could trade, you know, and hopefully make the property owners better off, the ones that actually were making a living from agriculture. Yeah, that it was a real struggle for a lot of people out there, but I don't want to undermine the folks that who were actually making a living. There were some people who were making a good living off of the land. No big equipment, no big combines or anything like that. There were people with some combines, but we're talking pretty small equipment is from a prairie's perspective. Pretty much the size of things that you would have seen on the prairies back in the 1950s, you know, 60 horsepower tractors, those small hopper combines. They were newer, but much smaller than what we would have out here.
Oh, how do I put this question? Just like economically, how were people doing there? Is it considered poor or prosperous, or like what was that like?
That area had a very depressed economy. You know, there was a state-owned mine. While I was there, it actually a 66% share of that mine was purchased by a large Chinese-based mining company. That sort of changed the way that mine was run. But prior to that, it was government-run. And, you know, I mentioned former Yugoslavia earlier in the conversation. And a lot of those practices that would have been taking place during communist times, a lot of nepotism and cronyism that would have been taking place under a communist regime, some of those things were really still problematic in that area. And so if you weren't linked up with, you know, the appropriate government superiors, I guess, then it'd be tough for you to get work to be able to make a living. So when we arrived out there and our staffing started growing and we started, you know, getting 100, 200, 300 staff and, you know, 95%+ of the folks were local, it really changed the dynamics of those little villages.
Let's talk about the results of your efforts. I understand from our conversations you had some pretty good success. Walk us through that. What did it look like?
Yeah, so going back to my earlier comment about the Serbian government changing the Mining Act, one of the big changes that they allowed for was the ability for a private company to expropriate if a project was declared in the public interest. And as I mentioned earlier, there were a few problematic folks on this project who maybe had invested a little bit more money on areas that we weren't necessarily chasing, who were trying to recuperate those investments, that weren't willing to work with us on what everyone else had signed for. When the dust settled on where we were prior to looking at an expropriation program, we were over 99% acquired as far as willing buyer, willing seller negotiations, which, you know, I think that's a tremendous result. Even in North America, you know, it's that's a really high number. Unfortunately, I left the project due to a company takeover just shortly before our company approached the state to ask for public interest. But I am familiar with the conversation that happened. And when the Ministry of Finance was approached to have the request of public interest be declared, and they're the ones that have to do it, it's the Ministry of Finance, they said, well, okay, you want this declaration of public interest, what are we talking, like 50% of the project? How many people said no? And when the results were brought to him that it was over 99%, he just looked at the company representative and said, this is a miracle. Like, absolutely, this project will be in the public interest. This is a no-brainer. And they had public interest mm-hmm. declared shortly thereafter. And so a few people ended up getting expropriated through the process. Some of them settled outside of expropriation, but there were a few that ultimately ended in that manner. But all in all, it was a really successful program.
That is amazing. Did they go on to build it? Did they go on to develop the mine?
Yeah. So they continued with construction when the new company came in, and about 2 months ago, the process and actually getting the ore out of the ore body and considered, you know, commercially ready to go. There's like a period where you can only take samples, and then you have to like prove those samples, and then you can eventually, after a couple months of that, then it becomes commercial. Those samples, that process, essentially, they're just waiting, I think, for a checkbox. Everything is running. Like the project will officially have its opening, I think, in September.
I had a guest on here earlier, well, a couple of months ago, who comes from the mining industry, and he was connecting the dots for me on how many pounds of copper are in an electric vehicle. And then if you add, you know, multiply that by how many vehicles may be on the road by whatever year, it's an awful lot of copper that would be required. So I would think that these types of operations will be needed, and more of them.
And that area is rich in copper. You know, copper has been being mined there for over 100 years. I think it's like 120 years that there's been commercial copper operations there. You know, the area there, it's called the Tethyan Belt, and there is a ton of copper in that area. And, you know, Serbia, by the way that they've been working with the private industry and promoting the development of these copper projects and other mining projects for that matter, they're ahead of a lot of other players in Eastern Europe as far as getting these projects off the ground and into service.
Tell us about some lessons learned. What can you share that you took away from the experience in Serbia and have been able to bring back to North America?
Well, I think the most important thing for me when I got there was my residence that I spent like 70%+ of my time was in Eastern Serbia, and it was in Bor. Immersing myself in the culture and really, really taking an appreciation for what, you know, struggles the people in the local area were going through, and that this was serious business. You know, I understood really quickly that land in Canada is likely one of the most important things people will ever own here, and it's near and dear to their heart. And whether it's been purchased by you through blood, sweat, and tears, or was handed to you by your parents or your ancestors through their blood, sweat, and tears of acquiring, it's exactly the same there. This is one of the most serious things you could ever talk with someone about. And it's one of the most important things that they have in their ownership is their property. That language is the same in English as it is in Serbian.
It makes sense. I would almost think more so there based on what you described. What kind of advice would you give someone who's looking to develop a project of their own? Whatever that may be, whether it's a pipeline or a mining project or a renewable energy project, which you've had experience in, what's some key tips you'd give?
Putting early emphasis on the communication with the local communities and other stakeholders, no matter what country you're working in. You know, I had one of the roles that I was also playing in Serbia was I was assisting the communications team with building an integrated communication strategy to ensure that all of the different stakeholders that were working with us or communicating with us, whether it was the media, the government, the local government, NGOs, property owners, the ministries, whoever it was that was working with us, we had a strategy to get ahead of those messages, even when we saw things bubbling up. If you lose the support of the community, if you don't have the property and you don't have the support, you don't have a project. There's another project that's actually going on in Serbia right now, where their communications program and land program didn't necessarily take off like ours did. I'm not sure exactly what happened, but the result was that the federal government there is actually holding a referendum to determine if a federal referendum to determine if that project is in the public interest. So where when we approached it and we had all the support from every single community, every village, not every single individual, but we had a ton of support from the locals. And I would say a big, big majority. And you could see that by the numbers. And then when you contrast it to the way this other project went, and that they actually have to hold a referendum to determine if they're going to make it go forward, which means ultimately expropriation. And I don't know what their numbers are for acquisition, but they must not be anywhere near as to what we had. You know, that just goes to show what kind of uncertainty will creep into your project if you don't work with people and be fair and consistent. I can't drill those words home enough to anyone who's trying to develop a project, because as soon as you grease a squeaky wheel, you've opened up a Pandora's box, and that news will flourish through the community, and you'll be seen as unfair, and you will lose support really quickly, and good luck after that, because bad news travels way faster than good news, as you likely know.
Well, it can take a lifetime or a full career of building on your reputation for being fair, and it can take one deal to ruin that reputation. And I think it's hard too. Once a project developer is back on their heels, it's hard to recover. It's hard to regain that trust. So that's great. That's great advice, Chris. Where can people find you if they want to reach out to you?
Best way to reach me on the public domain would be LinkedIn. I'm just Chris Lupischuk. I'm the only Chris Lupischuk on LinkedIn.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you, my friend. It's been fun doing this with you. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy hearing your experience in Serbia. So thanks again.
Thank you for having me. This was a pleasure to be on today, Chad. Thanks.